Okay, good evening, everyone. I hope you're able to hear me. If not, please send us a message. Okay. We're going to start. Sorry for technical difficulties. Welcome from Mr. Lyme Arcades. Tonight we're going to talk about the, as Shavuos was last week, Matan Torah, Kabbalah Torah, and Har Sinai. We're going to talk about the location of Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and what we can know from from archaeological and historical records to try to piece together the route, the general idea of the route that Bnei Yisrael took, coming out of Mitzrayim, going through the Midbar, going through the Sinai Desert, and making it to Ashkenaz. Okay, sorry, we're getting over technical difficulties and ready to run. The truth of the matter is that when we look at an archaeological point, we know Bnei Yisrael wandered in the Midbar for 40 years, and archaeologically speaking, if we know the period that Bnei Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim, and we will touch on that, but I hope not to put an emphasis on that too much, because I think that warrants a sheer lecture in itself. The general consensus of when Bnei Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim, if we're talking about the scientific dates, we're talking about somewhere between the 12th and 14th century BCE. And when we look archaeologically speaking in the Sinai Peninsula, when we look for remains of Bnei Yisrael, unfortunately, there's not much to show. Not much is putting it mildly. There's pretty much nothing to show. And which is one of the issues raised. How could it be Bnei Yisrael were there for 40 years and there's no trace of them? We're going to try to touch on that a drop. But the point is, we don't have archaeology to help us too much to identify the locations of Bnei Yisrael wandering in the Midbar. Now, why don't we have any remains? That's a good question up for grabs. But most probably, it was not a permanent settlement. It was a temporary settlement. There were tents. Bnei Yisrael wanted to move. And being that it's a temporary settlement, and when Bnei Yisrael pick up, they move with everything they have. They're living as nomads. They will not leave enough traces to be found in archaeological digs today. Archaeology is, with all its importance, it's far from being an exact science. And archaeology will always know what it finds, but it will never know what it didn't find. Which means, let's say the minimum archaeology can find is that we have a permanent settlement of 10,000 people living there, for example. So they'll never know if there was a settlement of 5,000 people there, because there's no traces of anything less than 10,000 people, for example. And for that reason, we never know if a temporary settlement were there. We'll never know if people lived there or not, because there's not much archaeological traces. For example, I give two quick examples. In the Negev Desert in Eretz Yisrael today, there are remains of burial sites from a certain archaeological period, but there are no traces of any settlements. So the people are buried there, but where did they live? So far, there's no archaeological trace of where they lived in that period. So the answer is they lived as nomads in tents, and there's not much to show for it, and therefore nothing ever surfaced archaeological. That's one example. Another example can be interesting at Hen Gedi, which we know from Tanakh existed from early periods of history, but archaeologically speaking, the permanent settlement, the first settlement found, is only from the days of the first Beis HaMikdash and on, the latter days of the first Beis HaMikdash. But nearby there's a massive temple which served the people hundreds of years before that, and it's the size is tremendous. but there was no settlement nearby. So where did the people come from? Obviously, the people lived there, but they lived in temporary settlements, and therefore there's no traces. The only thing that remained was this temple that was built as a permanent structure. So there's another example. So it's very hard to, we don't have traces of B'nai Yisrael in the Midbar. Again, it was a temporary location. People lived in tents. We know that. Matovah, Alech Yaakov, they never bothered building houses. Why build a house when he can be on the move the next day? So we don't have much that archaeology can help us to prove regarding B'nai Yisrael. So we have to use other methods that are going to try to get that are going to try to help us with a solution. I'd like to familiarize ourselves with the Sinai Peninsula. Click on number 9, please, the Sinai map. Click on number 9 from the source pages. Some of the links today are a little large. Can take a few minutes until they'll be able to load.
You're back on the air.
Try to bring up source number 9. Which is a map of
And when you go back on today, ask Rabbi Kornfeld if number 9 was put up.
Asking Rabbi Kornfeld if number 9 was posted. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a little difficulty with that. So while waiting, let me just talk a little about the Sinai Peninsula. Let me just talk a little about the Sinai Peninsula, which we know today. The entire Sinai Peninsula is called Midbar Sinai or the Sinai Desert. But in the times of the Torah, the Sinai Peninsula had various names. Different sections of it had different names. And on the Hebrew PDF source page, I quoted in source, the Hebrew PDF source page, section 1.3. We quoted the Gemara in Shabbos, where the Gemara in Shabbos says that Midbar Sinai, Har Sinai, has 5 names. It's called Midbar Chin. Shinstab Yisrael Olav, Yisrael were commanded on it. It's called Midbar Kodesh, because Shinstab Yisrael Olav, Yisrael was sanctified on it. It's called Midbar Kedemos, because the Torah, which is Kodom, which is early, was given on it. It's called Midbar Parom, because Yisrael, Parom, Barav, Olav, as Rashi explains, after Har Sinai, everyone went back to their tents. And 9 months later, the wives gave birth to a male child. And its real name was Choreh. So the Gemara seems to say that all these names, Parah, Tzin, Kedemos, are all names of the one, the Sinai Desert. Tell us what's over there, and tell us what's in Bava Kamal Aruchetz, as quoted on the Hebrew source page, section 1.4. Tell us what really proves that that this cannot be. In other words, that there's clearly evidence that these are different names of different sections of the Sinai Desert. Different sections of the Sinai Desert had different names, and we'll go with that theory. First of all, when B'nai Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim, the first place they went to is Midbar Shur. And Midbar Shur is the northwestern section of the Sinai Desert. The eastern section of the Sinai Desert is called Midbar Paran, and the north of that we have Midbar Tzin. Midbar Kedemos is, as Tosfos already points out, is in the eastern desert east of Jordan. So that's pretty far away from what we're discussing over here. We're trying to understand what the root of Bnei Israel took, and in order to get to Har Sinai, the Torah says like this, and PDF source page 2.1, we read the pesukim. Vayihi shalach paro ha'am. When Paro sent Bnei Yisrael, Hashem did not take him derech eretz Pelishtim, which we will explain this concept in a moment, kikarovu, because he didn't send them through or to the land of the Philistines, because it's close. Because Hashem said, lest the people will change their mind when they see war, for Shofar Mitzrayim, and they're going to change their mind and turn back and go back to Egypt. And therefore Hashem didn't take him through Eretz Plishtim, and instead, Hashem sent him Derech HaMidbar Yamsuf. Derech HaMidbar will be the region of the way of the Midbar Yamsuf to the Reed Sea, which today is known as the Red Sea, but the correct name should be the Reed Sea. Suf is Reed, and Yamsuf. Okay, so first of all, I want to explain this term, and a lot of people have made this mistake, probably under the influence of modern Hebrew, and misunderstood, and therefore it's important to to know this. When the Torah says Berach Eretz Plishtim, the term Berach will appear in the Torah and Tanakh numerous times. Okay, I see that source number 9 is up, and please look at it. You see the way of the land of the Philistines, the way to the sea, stands on top of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, when it says Derech, in modern Hebrew, if I say I went to somewhere, Derech, certain place, that means via, which would mean if I went to Eretz Yisrael, Derech Eretz Plishtim, that means I went to Eretz Yisrael through the land of the Plishtim. That's how it is in modern Hebrew. And when people today read Tanakh, the influence of modern Hebrew is evident, and they misunderstand the term. The term is incorrect. In Tanakh, anytime it says Derech, it's the name of the place that the road is leading to. Not via, but where the road is leading to. So if we have Derech Eretz Plishtim, it means the road that leads to the land of the Plishtim. Now this changes the entire meaning of the pasuk. Because if I read Hashem didn't lead him through the land of Plishtim because he was afraid they'd see war, they turned back, that would imply that the problem is in the land of the Plishtim they'll encounter war, and therefore they'll turn back. But if I say Hashem didn't lead him on the road to the Plishtim because they might turn back when they see war, that means that the road to the Plishtim is a convenient and easy road to travel back and forth. And if they travel on this road, they're going to encounter war and find the easy way back to Mitzrayim. Hashem doesn't want them to find the easy way back to Mitzrayim. But who will they encounter the war with? That the Torah doesn't say. And today we can safely say that one of the biggest problems of the war that they encounter is going to be with the Egyptians themselves. Take a look. You're looking at the map on source number 9 on the top of the Sinai Peninsula. It says the way of the land of the Philistines. This map, by the way, I took from a book by an Israeli professor, geographical professor Menashe Harel, where he has a whole book on the different routes, the different possibilities of Bnei Yisrael going through Sinai. And you have on top of the Sinai Peninsula the way of the land of the Philistines, the way of the sea. Now this was the common route that the Egyptian kings took any time they went out on their campaigns, on their conquests. And there were numerous conquests before Bnei Israel went out of Mitzrayim, all the way up north to Lebanon, all the way fighting with the Chitim up north. They always are going on this route. If you go back to the main source page, 13. Go to source number 13. This graphic might take a couple seconds to load. Take a look at this very interesting graphic. This is a graphic of an Egyptian king named Sitos, Seti, who is coming back from the conquest in Canaan, going back to Egypt. Now, on the right side, you see the women of Egypt coming out to greet him, and then you see a sea, and next to it, you see a dark section. There's an A, but it may be a little difficult to see it. You see some fish and crocodiles. Now, this was a canal of the Nile, which was dug purposely to prevent anyone from leaving Egypt or coming into Egypt. And all along the way, you see the king and his chariot. All along the way, like you see, like a G and an E on the bottom of the graphic. All these are fortresses or wells along the way in the northern Sinai. So in other words, the Egyptians are controlling this road, and there's a suspicion that Aben Ezra will encounter war and find the way easy, or the Egyptians will come chasing after them. And therefore, Hashem changes the route. Hashem changes the route. Go back to the name. Hashem changes the route. Bring up source number 12. This is a Hebrew map. This is a Hebrew map. Again, the Sinai, a Hebrew map taken from the Daat Mikra Chumash and in Bamidbar. The top again has Derech Eretz Plishtim, and that's the road that Bnei Israel didn't take, and Hashem takes him Derech HaMidbar Yam Suf. Again, Derech means the road to, when it was the road to the desert, Hashem takes him to Yam Suf. Yam Suf, now if you look at today's map, you'll get a little confused, because the map has changed. The Suez Canal has been dug over 100 years ago, and therefore the Yam Suf leads all the way straight into the Mediterranean. But in antiquity, of course, it didn't go like that. You have the Gulf of Suez, and then you have the Bitter Lakes, and again, this area is passable on dry land. And Hashem takes them to Yam Suf, and which means Hashem heads them south, and they're going to go all the way through the desert instead of taking the straight route. The straight route, by the way, we know the Egyptian kings could do cross the whole Sinai Desert within a matter of 10 days. We have a record from King Moses III, where he crossed the Sinai in 10 days. So it could have been the straight route in 10 days, and instead Hashem took him circling all the way down, taking him all the way down to a direction which we'll get to. Now, our main objective of this year is to try to find Mount Sinai. Before we start, I'll tell you that we're not going to have any definite conclusions, so don't be disappointed. But we're going to try to find the vicinity. And if we go in the vicinity, there are four main possibilities. And I'm going to start with the possibilities which we're not going to put the emphasis on, but we cannot ignore them. And one of the most interesting suggestions is that Mount Sinai is actually belonging to source number 8. Mount Sinai is actually in Midian. And Midian today is Saudi Arabia. If you go to source number 8, you see this map, and it's part of a major, source number 7 has a major site. It's a major theory that Mount Sinai should be in Saudi Arabia. Now, why would Mount Sinai be in Saudi Arabia? Again, I'm not responsible for the content on these sites. I'm just bringing these theories because there are these theories that exist, and I'll explain what they're based on. If you go to the Hebrew source page, section 5.1, we quote from Chumash Mos, "Moshe Hayaraes Tzom Yisrael Chosno Kehen Midyan." Moshe Rabbeinu was tending the sheep of his father Yisrael. He took the sheep after the desert, and he came to Hashem's mountain in Chorev. And a few pesukim later, Moshe Rabbeinu, Pasuk Yud-Aleph, says to Hashem, "What merit will Klal Yisrael have to go out of Mitzrayim?" And Hashem answers him, "Kiyayimach, I will be with you." And the sign is, when you go out of Mitzrayim, you will worship Hashem on this mountain. In other words, Hashem is saying, I'm taking you out of Mitzrayim, not just for physical freedom, but you are going to be accepting the Torah, Tabalas HaTorah on this mountain. So in other words, Moshe Rabbeinu is in Mijan, which is in northern Saudi Arabia today, and he takes the sheep of his father-in-law, he comes to Horeb, which is Har Sinai, where Hashem says that he will give the Torah on this mountain. So where, how far can this mountain be from Mijan? And therefore, the theory that Har Sinai is sitting in Saudi Arabia. On a certain mountain, if you go to, as you see here, and as you see in the map also, that they have Bnei Israel crossing the Yam Suf at a totally different location, crossing the Gulf of Aqaba. Go back a second. If you go to site number 7, I'm thinking, if you go to site number 7, that's a site that discusses the whole theory of Har Sinai being a Saudi Arabia. I'm not going to go into it's a good question, it's a problem. We don't have an answer, we don't have a solution for this problem. Again, I'm not responsible for all the content on the site. I bring it over there for, you know, as an example that you see. And as I said, this is not, you know, I can't say not far-fetched, but I'm saying it's, you know, the people who claim that we should be looking for the Midian have this, you know, from the Pesukim, which I don't have an answer for. In other words, how far the grill of Moshe Rabbeinu wander, I don't have an answer, but that's why they're looking for it in Har Sinai. That's why they're looking for it in Saudi Arabia. Another theory, which has been coming up today, and please go to number 6, is a place today in the Negev Desert in Israel called Har Karkum. It's on the center of the graphic on the right side. You see a big site called Har Karkum. That is today in the Negev Desert in Israel, near the border. And in recent years, it's become a major pilgrimage of people who believe that Har Sinai stood over there. Why did Har Sinai get over there? So I would say that the people who came to the conclusion that Har Karkum is the place where Har Sinai was, it's not so much because they read the Tanakh and came to the conclusion that that's where it was, but they came to Har Karkum and saw all the magnificent stuff on Har Karkum and decided this must be the place. Har Karkum is a mountain that has thousands of rock images that are, and you can say there's maybe 12 pillars over there, which we know that Moshe Rabbeinu made 12 monuments for Bnei Yisrael. So, if you go to 4, you have the archaeologist who's been in there, Dr. Emmanuel Anati. He has a whole essay, you can say, about why we should be looking for Har Sinai on Har Karkum. As I said, they tie it into a pasuk, which we'll get to in a moment. The biggest problem with putting Har Sinai and Har Karkum is that all the rock drawings that are there and all the civilization dates to a period which is hundreds of years before we believe the nation went out of Mitzrayim. And that's why I mentioned specifically that the general date that we believe the nation went out of Mitzrayim, the scientific date, is between the 12th and 14th century BCE. But all the civilization Har Karkum is much earlier than that, hundreds of years before that. Okay. Again, archaeology is not etched in stone, and things can change, and we can't prove them 100% wrong, but this is a general consensus. There are others who question this. Velikovsky, in his famous theory, who tried redoing the whole Egyptian chronology, and others. So, but Har Karkum, as I said, is more when you come there and you see it, so it is close to fitting a similar description that we find in the Torah, and therefore they try putting it over there on Har Karkum. As I said, we're not going to be considering that for Har Sinai again, with all due respect, and I mention it because, you know, there are people who think so, but that's not my personal opinion, and as we'll show what we believe. Let's go back to source number 9, and take a look at this map. This map over here done by Professor Menashe Harel, and in the northern part, right underneath where it says the way of the mountain of the Philistines, you see it has Mount Sinai and a question. It has Jebel Yelek, Mount Sinai. To the right of it, Jebel Halal, Mount Sinai. In other words, I can tell you that there's at least 23 different suggestions where Mount Sinai is. But in general, if we want to sum them up into four categories and four groups, is A, Saudi Arabia, B, Harkarkom, which is not a group or particular location. C, we have the northern theory, which means that B'nai Yisrael are wandering in the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. And the fourth suggestion puts it all the way down south in the lower part of Har Sinai, which we'll get to later on, because that's the direction which I'm heading, so we'll leave that for last. Why are people putting it in the north? So the key location that will put Har Sinai somewhere in the north is the following pasuk. Go to the Hebrew source page, the PDF file, source 3.1. The pasuk says like this: Achal asar yom mechorev derech haseir ad kadesh barnea. Literally, 11 days from chorev, derech haseir. And again, remember, when we said the word derech haseir, it means the road that leads to haseir. Ad kadesh barnea, until kadesh barnea. Kadesh barnea is a major stop in the history of Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael standing kadesh barnea. From there, they have an option to go straight up north into Eretz Yisrael. It's there they choose to send the Meraglim, and there they get the news that they will not be going into Eretz Canaan for a while, and they're wandering again. It's a major point. Now the little chat, and as Rashi explains in Devarah, Rashi says the shortest route from Chorev to Haseir is Derech Kadesh Barnea, is the road leading, the shortest route leading from Chorev to Kadesh Barnea is the road that takes you to Seir. And Seir, by the way, is Edom, which is in southern Jordan. And that normally takes 11 days. So if it normally takes 11 days, it's got to be, Chorev has got to be somewhere in the northern part of the Sinai within an 11-day range of Kadesh Barnea. Where is Kadesh Barnea? So back on this map, number 9, you see a site. You see a site, I would say, a third of the way down, and near the center, closer to your right, there's a site called Kadesh Barnea Kadesh, next to a site called Kusema. And this site, known in Arabic as Ein Kadrat, and next to Kusema, or Ein Kadis, this site is accepted by most as being the Kadesh Barnea mentioned in Tanakh. Kadesh Barnea, as we said, is the end of the wanderings of Bnei Yisrael had where they sent the spies, and that is also from Parshas Maaseh, the southern boundary of Eretz Yisrael. So Kadesh Barnea is right on the boundary, and from there going up, everything is disputed. No opinion again is absolute, and especially being in the desert, that only nomads live there, there's no continuous civilization, so no one can really say anything absolutely. But in general, it's accepted that this is indeed Kadesh Barnea. And again, so we have to be looking for somewhere within an 11-day walking range in order to find Har Sinai. And that's why these people are putting it in the north, as we saw before, Jebel Yelek or Jebel Halal, that's the people looking in the north. The one who actually made this map, Professor Menashe Harel, he has his own theory where he puts them through the middle, and that's where you see the chain of arrows. He has his own theory where Bnei Yisrael crossed the Yam Suf, and he has his own chain of arrows. He has his own theory. Again, with all due respect to the person, I respect him very much, but his theory is not widely accepted. In source number 3.3 on the Hebrew source page, there's a very interesting Sifri. The Sifri is the Medrash on Devarim. And the Sifri says like this, Achadas Yom Mechorev. So the Sifri wants to know what the definition is, 11 days. Does it take 11 days? It's only 3 days. Rabbi Yehuda says like this, V'chilishlosh Yom Mechorev Yisrael Malchid Alef Masalat, is it possible? By the way, this is in this week's Parsha. Barom Bis Hashem Nosel Ef Nehem Shlosh Yisrael. When they left Chorev, they left 3 days, and they traveled 3 days. So he says, is it possible that the Bnei Yisrael went in 3 days, enough of a traveling distance of 11 days? That's impossible, because it's not an 11-day distance. It's much further distance. How do we know this? So go to Pesukim. So go to your Hebrew PDF source page 3.2. And over there we have a very interesting, over there we have the quote from Malachim. According to Melachim Aleph Perek Tes, it tells the story of Eliyahu Hanavi. Eliyahu Hanavi had just wiped out the Nevi'im of Baal, and Yezebel, the queen, the wicked queen, warned him that he better run for his life, and he runs all the way to Be'er Sheva. And at Be'er Sheva, Amalek comes and gives him food to eat, and he starts walking, and he gives him more food. And then it says, Vayokom, Vayokom, Vayishte, and Vasukhash, he ate and he drank, Vayelech, Vatoach, Achila, Hai, Abaim Yom, Abaim Laila, Adhar, Lakim Choleh. He went 40 days and 40 nights, until he reached Hashem's mountain in Choreh. In other words, he reaches Har Sinai, it's a 40-day walking distance from Be'er Sheva. And that's why this Sefri that we just quoted says, how could you say that it's only 11 days when we see from the Pesukim that we're talking about a 40-day distance? And that's why the Sefri says we cannot accept this pshat that it's really an 11-day distance because it's really a 40-day distance. So we see clearly from the Pesukim and Melachim that the distance from Be'er Sheva until which is clearly visible on the English map, north of Nitzana over there, Kusema, you see Be'er Sheva, not so far from Kadesh Barnea, you would say, maybe a few days walking distance, and from there all the way down to the tip of Sinai, the furthest point, that there you'll have a 40-day walking distance. So we should be looking for Har Sinai all the way in the south of the Sinai Peninsula, a long distance away. So that's why we're going to be heading south and trying to analyze what's going on over there. First, we'll talk a little about the Kriyas Yam Suf. Where did Bnei Yisrael actually cross the Red Sea or the Reed Sea? So I quoted a whole Tosfos here on the Hebrew source page, but I'm not going to read it because time is short. I will just send you a reference to it. That's 2.2 on the Hebrew source page. What Tosfos already raises an issue and proves that when Bnei Yisrael crossed the Yam, it was possible for the Egyptians to follow them on dry land. And it was for that reason that Bnei Yisrael suspected that the Egyptians indeed took a different route and will catch up to them. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu davened that Hashem should cause the Yam to spit out the dead Egyptians and the chariots so that they'll see that they're dead, and that's when the prophet said, Vayar Yisrael Shemshayim Nesos Vasayom. Taking into details, it's also evidently understood that the Yam Suf, as we would understand ourselves, is a sea that you cross from one side to the other, not imagining that it could be a gulf, like the Gulf of Suez. But today, that we see the map of another Gulf of Suez, it's most likely that Bnei Yisrael crossed the Yam Suf at some area south of the tip of the Gulf of Suez. I'm not going to go into whole scientific research, which a hydrographic engineer by the name of Moshe Dayan, no connection to the Israeli defense minister, came to his conclusion that indeed that is the only possible place. I don't accept his theories, but it's an interesting analysis of the topographical, of the reefs over there exactly, and the tides, and how it can happen, and when it can happen, and he comes close. I'm not going to say that he does a nice job, or he comes perfect, but he comes close. And Bnei Yisrael, that's where he says the tip of the Gulf of Suez is a place where they crossed. And from there, the Egyptians can easily go around from the north, there's no Suez Canal, and catch up to them on the other side. From there, Bnei Yisrael will be heading south, because as we just proved, the Har Sinai is far away from anywhere. Well, it's a 40-day from Be'er Sheva, it's all the way going to the south, all the way going south. Interesting is that in the Masos, in the and Pashas Masay were a list of places where Bnei Yisrael camp. They reach Yam Suf one more time after they already crossed the Yam Suf, which Tosfos already asked the question, what do you mean he crossed the Yam Suf already, how do you get the Yam Suf again? Again, Tosfos didn't have maps as we have today, and what we see from the maps today is that they crossed the Yam Suf, but from then on they didn't head east towards Eretz Canaan, but instead they headed south, so they're going parallel to the Gulf of Suez. There's one spot along the road where they have no choice, but because of the mountains, they have no choice but to camp exactly on the edge of the edge of the mountains, which pretty much point to the sea. They have to camp right on the Yam Suf. So that would seem the explanation of how Bnei Yisrael come back to the Yam Suf again, even though they crossed it before. They're heading south, and by the way, For the layout of the Sinai Peninsula, it's important to note that the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula is pretty straight. As you go south, that's where the mountains really begin. Not that there are no mountains elsewhere, but I'm saying in general, the highest mountains in the Sinai Peninsula are in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Take a look now. We're going to focus on the southern tip of the Sinai Desert. And we look over there, we see a place which is commonly known, the monastery. And not going to mention it by name. The monastery is sitting over there, and that's the place which for Christian tradition already at least 1700 years is the location of Har Sinai. Not exactly where the monastery is, because the monastery is not on a mountain, but there's south of it Jebel Katrina, and west of it there is Jebel Musa, which I believe Jebel Musa is actually the highest mountain in the Sinai Peninsula. So is this the Har Sinai the way traditionally they say it or not? What has going for it is an interesting thing, is that the rock over there has a very interesting design on it. And it's a design of a bush. The snare, the burning bush that Hashem revealed himself to Moshe Rabbeinu, is etched in the rock on that mountain. And if you crack open the rock, you'll find more of it. You can't get rid of it. And these rocks are for sale, by the way, in places. So that's what people say, this must be indeed the mountain, because proof to it is the fact that the snare is sitting there. This is the highest mountain in the Sinai Peninsula. So is this a mountain or not? So very interesting, on the Hebrew PDF source page, I do have one source in English, and that's the last one over there, and it's a quote from Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews. You have to keep in mind, Josephus, whether he's accurate on these things or not, but that means that we're talking about something very ancient. Josephus lived in times of second base, I mean it was 2,000 years ago, and in the Boyle type, I just quote, when he said this, talking about Moshe Rabbeinu and the preparation, going up, getting the Torah, he ascended up to Mount Sinai, which is the highest of all the mountains that are in that country. So in other words, Josephus clearly states that Har Sinai is the highest mountain in the whole country, which means what, in the whole vicinity, in the whole Sinai Peninsula, this is the highest mountain, and that's what you should be looking for, Har Sinai. So that's an interesting thing, and we'll soon see if that fits with our sources or not. But it seems that the Christian tradition of putting Har Sinai on that mountain could very well be based on Josephus. The Christians were very familiar with Josephus, and it could be based on Josephus. There's some that say that this tradition, the Christian tradition, should be accepted. It's based on a very interesting Gemara in Bava Basra, and that you can find on the Hebrew PDF source page 6.1. I'm not going to read the whole thing because time is short. As usual, we run out of time, and I want to focus on one more site before we have a chat and before we finish. A very interesting site which does connect to Bnei Yisrael. It says like this. It says that Rabbi Baba Chana, it's a famous Gemara in Bava Basra with a lot of stories of Rabbi Baba Chana, some amazing, fascinating stories. And Rabbi Baba Chana met up with an Arab, and he says, come and let me show you where Mount Sinai is. And he saw the Mount Sinai, and he saw that there was a scorpion that was standing like a white donkey, and the basketball said, woe that I have sworn, who is going to permit this shvuah for me? So let's not get into that, because that's, we really don't have time to focus on that. But what do we see? We see that we have an Arab living in the 2nd, 3rd century, and he takes Rabbi Baba Chana to see Har Sinai. So in other words, we can assume that this was a local Arab who lived in the desert, and this is the same time that the Christian tradition we can date it back to. So in other words, some want to say, if so, so that indeed, this is indeed the location of Har Sinai, and that's what we should be looking for, the highest mountain, Jebel Musa, the highest mountain in the Sinai. There is one major problem with that, and that, if you go on to the next source on the Hebrew source page 6.2, the Gemara refers to a famous Chazal, and it talks about when Hashem offered the Torah to be given, so a lot of mountains came forward and offered their services. The Har Tabor in Israel, or the Har Carmel, or the Hermon. Those high mountains offered themselves to come and have the Torah given on them. And Hashem rejected them. And why did he reject them? Because they're hot. And the Torah is not supposed to be people who are Bali Gaiva, people who are hoarded. It's supposed to be for people who are humble. And therefore Hashem chose to give it on Har Sinai, which is a humble mountain, and not to give it on a tall mountain like the Tabor or the Carmel or the Hermon. And the Gemara continues over there and concludes, Har Gavnonim, Har Bashan. Lama Tirtu Dinim Sinai, Kulchem Bali Mumim Rintel Sinai. Hashem says all these mountains, you are Bali Mumim, you have a blemish. In other words, you're tall, you're high, that's no good. I don't want that. I don't want a low mountain. And therefore, Har Sinai will get the Torah given on you, and not Har Carmel, and not Har Tavor. As I'll say, Hashem rewarded them nonetheless for their effort, but we don't have time to go into that now, so we will not, Hashem rewarded them. Okay, we'll say briefly that on Har Sinai, Hashem said, Enoch Hashem Elokecha once, and on Har Carmel, Bnei Yisrael said, Hashem Elokim twice in the days of Eliyahu, and on Har Tavor, Devorah, with Ashira said, Anochi Hashem Anochi Ashira, she said Hashem's name twice. So that is the problem with accepting the theory that Jebel Musa, the highest mountain in the area, is Har Sinai. But, as we said, A, we will not reach any conclusions out of all the 23. We're just trying to pinpoint an area. And B, it's probably somewhere in that area, because that area is the only area that fits the distance of 40 days from Beersheba. Again, we see that there was an ancient tradition. Josephus said that it wasn't the highest mountain in the area, but according to the Gemara, it was not the highest mountain in the area. We should be looking for it in the Sinai Peninsula. So that's pretty much the general picture. Again, as I said, we sum it up. We have four major theories: Saudi Arabia, Hakakom, the northern theory, and the southern theory. There is though one thing that I think we should put an emphasis, and it also connects with Matan Torah, and that's the site in Sinai. And if you can, if you look up, go back to the Sinai map on 9, and a little north of, let's put it where you see in the Gulf of Suez, you see Abu Rhodes. You see Abu Rhodes, a little to the right of it, you see a site called Sarabit al-Hadam Temple. This is a very interesting site, maybe not known too much, but this I think is the one site in the entire Sinai Peninsula that can tie something to Bnei Yisrael in the desert, is this site over here. If you go to the main source page, go to number 2, and number 2 is an Egyptian page about the history of this site called Sarabit al-Hanan. This is a mining area where the Egyptians mined turquoise, which is a gem. They mined throughout the ages, and there are a lot of monuments over there for kings throughout the ages. They were mining there, but it seems that the Egyptians never did the work themselves. They always had slaves coming from other places. And what's interesting is that 100 years ago, 100 years ago, Flinders Petrie did excavations there, and he discovered a very interesting thing. Go into source number 10. You see this little stone over here with some of these designs, and these designs might mean nothing to you, but these designs are probably one of the greatest inventions of all time. And this is what we know as being the first alphabet. Now let me explain to you the difference between the Egyptians and the Egyptians, the Babylonians, and the alphabet. The Egyptians wrote with hieroglyphics. The Babylonians, they wrote with a thing called cuneiform. These things are symbols. They're not sounds of symbols. There are thousands of these symbols. Let's compare today to someone who tries learning Japanese or Chinese. Their alphabet is not an alphabet, it's symbols. And there are hundreds and thousands of these symbols. Now you can imagine ancient times when they didn't have organized schooling like we have today. Who can afford to teach his son, to get a tutor, to teach his son to read and write? Only Only people who really had a lot of money, only the rich people. The poor people, the peasants, were kept, remaining peasants, because they'll never have a chance to have a son to learn reading and writing. And this way, the aristocratic society remained separate from the rest of the society, because basically the rest of society did not have this opportunity to learn reading and writing. The alphabet, the greatest invention, is where instead of having hundreds or thousands of symbols, it's based on phonetics. In other words, the 27 letters have different, 27 or 22 have sounds, and these sounds can include all the words, and this way everyone is able to read and write. Everyone has this opportunity. If we go to 11, these are some of the designs. There are two diagrams here. The top one is this is the earliest alphabet. It's known as Proto-Sinaitic, found in Sinai, and the top one is red from right to left, and the bottom one is read from top to bottom. Eventually, as there was evolution, and today, you know, the Hebrew alphabets are read from right to left. But these are the writings. These are the original alphabet, and if you go to... If you go to source number 2, that's a Hebrew... 3, sorry. Source number 3, it's a Hebrew site. Go down where you see the development of the alphabet and how the evolution of it. The number one on the right side is the Proto-Sinaitic, and slowly it became what we know as the ancient Hebrew script. Now, why is this important for us? Because if you go to your Hebrew source page, again, you see a very interesting thing. It says when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the Luchos, Ma'aseh Elokim Hema, they were miraculous. And if you go to the Hebrew source page 4.1, you'll see that the Gemara in Megillah says that the Mem and the Samach and the Luchos stood there miraculously. Now the Mem, the end Mem, is a total block. And the Samach is also, in other words, from all four sides. So you have the middle section. What is keeping the middle section in place? Remember, the Luchos are written, Mizel Mizehen Ksuvim. The inscription penetrated from one side to the other. So what is keeping the centerpiece in place? And that, the Gemara says, was a miracle. That was a miracle that the Samach and the Mem remained in place. That is how the Bavli takes it. But the Yerushalmi has a whole different opinion. And I quoted the Yerushalmi, I'm not going to read it verbatim, but I quoted the Yerushalmi source 4.2 from the Yerushalmi Megillah. The Yerushalmi Megillah discusses an issue. Today, we have a Sefer Torah. It's written in a writing called the Kitab Ashuri. In ancient times, Bnei Yisrael used a script called Ksav Ivri, the Hebrew script, which on this source page you see some examples of it. The question is, which raised over here, is which is the original writing that Bnei Yisrael had? Was the original writing the Ksav Ivri, and then in the days of Ezra was changed to Ksav Ashuri? Or was the original writing Ksav Ashuri, and then it was changed to Ivri sometime, and then Ezra changed it back, he restored it to the way it was. So, in other words, the issue is, when the Torah was given, what was it written in? The ancient Hebrew script, or in the Ksav Ashuri today? So Yerushalmi says like this. Either way, there was a miracle with the Luchos. But the question was, the miracle was with what letters? If it was written in the Ksav Ashuri like today, so then the miracle was with the Mem and the Samach. The Mem and the Samach had the middle block, which didn't fall out. But if it was written with the Ksav Ivri, so then the miracle was with the Ayin. Take a look on this page over here, and look at the Ayin. And by the way, it originally began not only as phonetics, but phonetics make it easy to remember. So in other words, the symbol represented something that was familiar. So if a person wanted to use an Ayin, he would look at the symbol, and the symbol represents an I, and he'd right away know that we're talking about an Ayin. And the cuff is the hand, and the dalet is a dog, is a fish, and so on and so forth. So the Yerushalmi says that if we're going with the original, if the Torah was given to Ksav Ivri, so then it's actually the ayin that was the miracle. It was the ayin in the ancient Hebrew script is the samach when we have it today. So again, we see this, and this is the alphabet. that was found in Sefer Beter Chadam, the earliest alphabet that we can trace back, but it definitely proves that there were Semitic people, because it's definitely beyond doubt the Semitics who invented the alphabet, definitely proves that there were Semitic people in Sefer Beter Chadam. Another interesting find in Sefer Beter Chadam, and this is very, very important for us, is number 14. The top section of number 14, we see three stone altars. Now, Petrie discovered these stone altars in Sefer Beter Chadam 100 years ago, and he right away said, this again proves, by the way, I didn't mention the dating of the alphabet, but today, you know, when Petrie found it, he thought that it was an early date. Today, we know from excavations at Lachish and whatever, that it's a little later. And I was talking about near the time when Bnei Israel went out of Mitzrayim. So that's safe to say. Petrie also found these stone altars, which were used for ketores, for incense. And he right away said this is again evidence of Semitics, because the Egyptians never offered incense on a stone altar. They offered it on a pen. And if it's on a stone altar, it is a sign of Semitic people. Go down to the bottom of this page, and you see another stone altar. This stone altar was discovered by an archaeologist named Adam Zertal on Har Ebal. Now, Har Ebal warrants a whole story in itself, but time is short, maybe some other time. But Har Ebal, when Bnei Yisrael come into Canaan, they're commanded to build a Mizbeach on Har Ebal. And for years, a lot of scientists, a lot of archaeologists have been hunting and searching for the Mizbeach where they thought it should be, and didn't come up with anything. But in 1982, Adam Zertal was not religious, but had no idea what a Mizbeach even looked like, dug up this site in Har Ebal, on the other side of Har Ebal, on the northern side, not where anyone ever expected to find the Mizbeach. And lo and behold, he found the Mizbeach, which dates back to that period of Bnei Yisrael coming out of Mitzrayim. And if you remember, I told you, it's somewhere between the 12th and 14th century, and he has evidence over there that the material came from the days of the king Ramses II, which is, again, the 12th century B.C. So now we're talking about Bnei Yisrael coming out of Mitzrayim, and he finds this stone altar, which he says is similar to one of the altars that Petrie found. I have to be honest with you, I didn't exactly find the resemblance on the pictures, it's a little hard to see, I even called them up, but they're basically stone altars. It could be that there are no stone altars anywhere else. I'm not sure. I don't know the details, I spoke to him briefly last week, but he resembles the one on the left, yes, probably resembles the most. There's a fourth, which I didn't show over here, that he found at least four stone altars. And now, remember, who built this altar? Who built the altar on the Mizbeach, on Har Ebal? Who built this? The Israelites, coming from Canaan. So in other words, we see the influence, we see the connection between this site over here with the alphabet and Bnei Yisrael coming from Canaan. Now, I also asked him another question, coming into Canaan. I also asked him another question. The rock, this material, this altar, where did the rock come from? And the fascinating answer he gave me is it's a type of volcanic rock which is only found in Jordan. So in other words, the people who brought it to this altar on Har Ebal must have come from Jordan. And there again is the clear evidence of Bnei Yisrael coming into Canaan. They were supposed to come from Kadesh Barnea north, but after the story of the Meraglim, and then they tried through Eretz Edom, and Hashem circled them all the way around, and then they indeed came in from Eber Yarden. They came in from Jordan and crossed over. So once again, there is somewhat evidence to Bnei Yisrael wandering and coming into Eretz Canaan is this stone altar, which came from Jordan and came all the way into Har Ebal. It was brought to Har Ebal, again, a proof of Bnei Yisrael on the Midbar. I'm going to finish off. We started up late, so I'm take a two more minutes of your time with one more interesting find, number 17. And I can't necessarily tell you definitely, it's a small thing on the thing, I can't tell you for sure that this has to do with Bnei Yisrael or not. But this is a fascinating story of the Timna copper mines. The Timna copper mines are located near Eilat, and the Egyptians, just as they were mining turquoise in Sefer Beter Chadam, were mining copper in Timna. And they had a temple over there, they had their god who was in charge of the mines, Avodah Zarah, and took offerings. But after a while, the Egyptians, for some reason, did not return. Probably after Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, the Egyptian empire started crumbling. And the local Midianites, they started they started mining over there. And they took this temple, that the Egyptian temple, they got rid of all the Avodah Zarahs, all the idols, and the only thing that they had in the sanctuary was this copper snake with a golden head. What does this copper snake remind us of? When Bnei Yisrael are going up, they're attacked by snakes, and Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, make yourself a snake and hang it up, and whoever's bitten by a snake will see it and live. And Moshe Rabbeinu makes a copper snake. So here we see a group of people who are not worshiping Avodah Zarah, but the one thing that they do keep, the one thing they do allow themselves to have, is a copper snake. We know that this copper snake was made by Moshe Rabbeinu. It was later worshipped as Avodah Zarah, but no one dared touch it because Moshe Rabbeinu made it. The only one who finally put it away was King Chizkiyahu hundreds of years later. So again, we see this idea, again, a nation who's not worshipping Avodah Zarah, but a copper snake for someone is okay, resembles very much the story of Bnei Yisrael, who crossed in that area. That's not what Moshe Rabbeinu made it. Moshe Rabbeinu probably made it a place called Punon, which has its own copper a little farther north on the Jordanian side. But again, so we do have some traces of Bnei Yisrael in the wandering. We have in Sarbet al Chadam, which matches Har Ebal, and we have this copper snake. That's pretty much the only things that we can actually say that we have to show from Bnei Yisrael wandering in the Midbar. As I said, the major explanation is they were there, not a permanent settlement, temporary settlements, and therefore therefore there's not many traces remaining. Okay, thank you.